Welcome to Subcreation, the podcast that seeks and finds the divine in art, story, even muscle cars, and everything in between. Hello, welcome back. Thank you for being with me. Always an honor and a joy for me to be with you. This is something I enjoy doing, and I appreciate you tuning in, because otherwise I probably wouldn't do it. So thank you. You know, I've called this podcast Subcreation because I got that name from J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings. And the book that really, really, really mesmerized me when I was a kid was a book called The Hobbit. So I feel like out of deference and respect to Tolkien, I need to talk about his books, at least about this one, The Hobbit. So that's where we're going to begin today. I remember Mrs. Perry, my teacher, when we'd come in after recess to settle us down, she started reading this book called The Hobbit. I never heard of it, didn't want to, was totally uninterested, didn't want to be read to. I thought I was too big for that. Again, I was in fifth grade. Then she began reading. And it didn't take long before I and the entire classroom, and it wasn't just one classroom, it was two classrooms, because they had a partition in the middle, and they opened it up, and both classes came together, and she began to read. And she read this book, and I was mesmerized, captivated, unlike I had ever been before. And what that book did for me was instill in me a love of reading. And fortunately, she did that in the fall of my fifth grade year, because for Christmas that year, guess what I asked for? The box set. And I still have it. Here's The Hobbit right here. Yes, it's a little bit worse for the wear, but you can still use it and still read it. And I still have the books. And I've read them and I've enjoyed them ever since. In fact, I just read The Hobbit, reread The Hobbit last spring. So it's something that I think we can look at and share with our children and grandchildren and reread as adults over and over again. One of the things that Tolkien said was, and C.S. Lewis agreed with him, these are not children's books. These are books for anybody. This was true for fairy tales. They're books for everyone. They can be read to children, but there's something to be gained no matter what your age. And I think there is something in us as adults that still wants, we want the awe, we want the wonder, we want the adventure that can only be offered in a story or offered in something that's interesting. And so he wrote this for just such audiences, knowing that those audiences are anyone from fifth grade to the grave. All right, so let's turn our attention there, but I want to begin by placing The Hobbit in a larger category or genre of literature that some say Tolkien invented. And that's the genre of literature called fantasy. Almost all the fantasy books that have come after just seem to copy or mimic some facet of Tolkien's, but they don't quite get the genius, in my opinion, that was captured in his. Not just because he was original, but because he understood what he was trying to do. He believed that there's a deeper story, or you could say it, a larger story, that is written into the created story, our temporal realm. We participate in it, whether you want to think of it as going deeper, that's that meaning undergirds all the other meanings, or if you want to think of it as overarching or both. And for a story to be good, it has to somehow capture that deeper or overarching meaning, but not do it in a way that sounds preachy. Furthermore, the meaning therein has an awe to it, a wonder to it, because there's something mysterious about it. Something that transcends our ability to fully grasp and capture it. For example, if you've ever told a joke and someone doesn't get it, and then you explain the joke, and now the joke's not funny. They get it, but they don't understand why you laughed. Maybe they give a courtesy laugh because they don't want you to feel bad, or they don't want to look dumb, but it's not funny anymore on that telling. So it is with storytelling. If you have to explain it too much, then you miss something. There's something in the telling of the story that is really beautiful and unique that you can't quite grasp just with facts and figures. And that's what Tolkien meant by fantasy. I think in our modern world, we think of fantasy as something I secretly want. And hopefully someday I'll get. And it's tied to desire. this is not what Tolkien meant by fantasy, and certainly this is not what's meant in the genre of literature. No, this type of fantasy is, yes, it's meant for both child and adult, as I said. Someone could even say it's meant for the child within, but I actually think it's meant for that desire within for story, for interest, for awe, for wonder, as I said. And that's not a child's thing. It gets awakened in children. They feel very comfortable in their realm of imagination. That's why they can play with toys. And adults, we can't. We can't play with children's toys. There's lots of people who have boy toys as grown adults, whether it's cars or boats or whatever. So we do move out of that expression of childhood where we want toys, but that's where the imagination kicks in. And we begin to have a world that mimics this world, but that is our world, but we can still be a part of, even though we're out of it. So we both transcend and enter into it as children. And that's what fantasy does. That's what it's meant to be. It's supposed to teach us something about our world while we enter into that world. Fantasy literature will lose its identity, I think, if it tries to explain too much, or if it's too imitative or too preachy. If it tries to offer too much variety or tries to get too political, then you miss the whole point. This is something that transcends what we find valuable in the here and now, that's tied to the spirit of the age. It's something perennial, something mysterious, something that draws us in, and then from that we can begin to learn about the world that we operate in an everyday way. And so that we see a connectivity, even though we recognize it as not being the real world, we still see the connection to it. So in recovering this sense, this awe and this wonder sense, this sense of the mystery, this sense that can't be completely articulated, this is what I think we mean by the word enchanted. Think of that word. It means to chant, to sing back and forth, a praise of something. Usually of God. It's how it was taken in the monastic tradition in the old in the Middle Ages, and in the early ages after the ascension of Jesus. But there's also a sense of this enchanted nature with creation, this song of praise and wonder offered to God through creation, offered in response to the beauty that one experiences. That's what it means to be enchanted, where I'm drawn into a harmony. It's a music that I might not hear, but that I see or feel or experience. I grew up in Colorado. I felt that all the time when I went to the mountains growing up. All right, so we want this. This is a quality of fantasy, this enchantment. There's a similar structure that correlates to our memory. And our memory, sometimes we remember things, and some things in an astonishing detail, while other things we should remember, we don't. Why is that? Because the astonishing detail resonates with us in a deep way, whether it's fear or excitement or joy and happiness or enthusiasm or anger. And then our memory clings to those things because of those emotions that are aroused. So fantasy corresponds to these contours of our memory. They're to bring out in the story those things, and then we will experience them. We're supposed to experience it while we're reading it. But that initial excitement, that initial discovery, that was really something, because it surprised me. Now I kind of know what's in there, so I'm not as surprised. But with that kind of surprise, that was an experience of this enchantment, of this beauty, of this awe that fantasy is to capture for us. And then we gain this insight. So Tolkien, he tiered these levels of meanings in The Hobbit, and he made it clear he's not writing an allegory. He said an allegory is where the author restricts the reader. And he's telling the reader, okay, X means Y. So when you see X, I actually mean Y. Now you can do that, that's fine, but he felt like you're limiting the reader when you do that. He said rather, he called it applicability. That's the word he used, applicability. You want to read it and find it applicable to your sense of meaning. And thus, multiple layers of meaning are open when you do that. So for you, it might mean this or it might mean that, and it can all be true. It doesn't conflict. And the interesting thing in his novels, in his I guess you could call it a novel, from The Hobbit all the way to The Return of the King, this long story, is that even though you've got talking trees and dwarves and elves and giant spiders and what have you, the virtue, the heroism, the self-sacrifice, the nature of humility, and how that created a hero out of Bilbo and then his nephew Frodo. These things are true in our world today, and they're truths that we wouldn't necessarily recognize. And then in this story, he shows us how that could be, and then we can turn to our real world and say, okay, now I can understand maybe this heroic event better, or I appreciate this character better, this historical figure better, by the fact that the truth of their this dimension and truth of their being is brought to light in this story, in the fictional account here of The Hobbit. So these are the meanings that he put in there. And I don't think he sat down, as an allegory, you're going to sit down and you're going to say, okay, so this has to mean that, and this has to mean that, and this has to mean that. I don't think he did that. I think he sat down and just started writing. And the meaning was already in him, because he had already had informed in him a worldview where you have tiered meanings, layers of meanings, deeper meanings that correspond. That's the idea and the understanding behind harmony. It's just like when you're playing an instrument, let's say a piano. You don't just hit one note, you hit a myriad of notes. You can hit 10 notes at one time, and you hit them all, and it brings out a resonance, a richness, because each of those notes work together to produce that chord. Experience that drives home the point. All right, so good. So let's get to the story. I'm going to give you a quick summary anyway of the book. So Gandalf is a wizard. He selects Bilbo, who's a hobbit, who's a little dude, a dwarf, if you will. He's not a dwarf because there's dwarves in there too, but he's short. And he lives in a hole, but it's not a dusty hole. It's a home that is a hole in a hill, but that it's got floor and windows and doors and candles and tables and furniture. So it's rather nice. But he's unassuming. The whole idea, the word humility is drawn from the same word where we get the word hummus, like you eat it, or you can also put it on your garden. It's, it means to be of the earth, something earthy. And that's what humility means. So he lives literally in the earth to show us this is how humble this guy is. And when Gandalf comes, this wizard, he chooses him to be a burglar, he calls him, because he wants him to spy out and help them capture some things that don't belong to the current possessors of those things, to give them back to the original recipients. So a burglar in a good sense. He's doing Gandalf a favor of returning a property to people who own it, but it's currently under the possession of somebody else who took it unfairly. And so this means that he has to go on an adventure. And so Bilbo makes very clear to him, I'm a hobbit, we don't do that. So I think here's an interesting theme, this reluctant hero. And Bilbo most certainly is a reluctant hero. He does not want to leave his home. Another theme, the idea of home, the idea of the Shire, a quiet village, simple people living off the land. They all know each other. They're at one with nature because they work the fields. They have fun. But so there's a certain levity in the neighborhood, in the town where they live, in the village. But there's also seriousness there because there's bickering between family members. So you see the fallen nature within Middle Earth, just like on our Earth. But you can also see that Tolkien yearns for that. He experienced that as a youth, and then he went off to war, World War I, and was so shaken by that, as was everyone who was involved in it. There was no way to be prepared for that. It was so traumatic. But what that did is that ingrained in Tolkien this sense of home, a sense of security, your place in the world. Bilbo knows this. He doesn't want to leave it, but he's willing, because the dwarves start showing up. And they're the ones he's going to burgle for. And so Gandalf is playing a figure. He's the wizard. But this word wizard actually shares the same root as the word wisdom. He's not a wizard in the sense that he wants to use his magic to impress people or to empower himself or improve himself to gain wealth or fame or power and, you know, kill people and blow things up just because he can. Rather, he's the kind of wizard that's tied to wisdom. He does have the power to do certain things, but only when it's wise to do so. And since rarely is that the case, rarely does he use his magic. Instead, he's almost the kind of prophet of the group. He foresees something bigger. He is a wizard because he's got a foot in Middle Earth, but he also has a foot in these other realms of deeper meaning, of understanding the plan of it all, the deeper secrets that undergird reality that most people don't know. He doesn't know all of those, but he knows of them and he knows enough of them that that's why he's a bridge figure. That's why he, as a wizard, he is tied more to wisdom and this prophetic vision. And so he realizes we've got to accomplish something great, so I've got to choose of all the people I'm aware of the kind of person who could accomplish something great. And then that's what makes sort of the irony in the whole story. He doesn't choose great kings or great warriors. They're in the story too. Nor does he choose other powerful figures. There's a figure in the story named Beorn who can turn into a bear at night. He doesn't use him either. Even though Beorn is good, he's scary. There's something mysterious about him you can't understand, but he's good. Gandalf doesn't use him. He chooses Bilbo, this little guy who lives in a hole under the hill. In fact, that's his last name, Underhill. And he has no reason. There's no reason to think that he could be a hero. We see some parallels, certainly, with Bilbo and other actual historical figures who were not ready for the adventure that they were called to. And yet they do it anyway. And in doing it, they get readied. And we oftentimes think that it's the big, the strong, the aggressive who are the heroes. We don't think that it's the quiet, the shy, the diminutive, like Bilbo, people who are quite happy just reading a book, smoking a pipe, sitting at home by the hearth, which is Bilbo, having a pint or a piece of cheese. This humble nature actually is a power, is actually the true power, more powerful than what we think of as power. And Gandalf in his wisdom knows this. And this is how Bilbo is going to be prepared. So off they go on their journey, and he goes with these dwarves, and they're off to fight a dragon. This ragtag band of a handful of dwarves who are all that's left of Thorin Oakenshield, their king. He's going back to reclaim his kingdom, and he knows a dragon has it. So it makes you think, okay, this is stupid. This is a huge gap in the story. Why didn't Tolkien think this through? How do these guys, they know what's awaiting them, this huge red dragon? What makes them think they're going to succeed? Well, in the one, as you see, that they're all heroic and they're all deeply flawed. Another theme in the Lord of the Rings and in The Hobbit in particular. They're greedy, they're proud. In fact, the greed and the pride leads to wars towards the end of the book and ends up taking Thorin's life. So we see the flaw, but we also see the loyalty and the recognition that if it's good, I need to try to do it for the good of my family, for the loyalty of my kin. This dragon took our gold, and the rumor was that he hadn't been seen in so long, maybe he was dead. So I think there was some of that hope that we'll get there, we'll get in his lair and find out that his bones are there and he's not, and we can regain the gold that we know is there. Regardless of what their motive, and perhaps is a combination of all those things, they go on this and they constantly get into trouble. And here's another theme, the theme of monsters. You've got trolls and orcs and goblins and giant spiders and this dragon, and it's scary. But they constantly fall into trouble, but then Gandalf comes to save them, but only as needed. Because as they go on this adventure and they get in this trouble, they find weapons, in particular swords that are known. Another theme, swords that tie the bearer to the ancient past. And it's the possession of a particular sword for Bilbo, he calls it Sting, that glows blue when orcs are around. So he's warned, so it's got some kind of special power, and he starts discovering his courage. But then something else happens. As they're taken captive in a cave at night by goblins who come out of a crack in a wall that opens, and they're taken down into the depths of Goblin Town down there. Bilbo ends up getting separated from the dwarves, and he tumbles down because he's so small, And he goes further into the depths of this mountain and comes across a pond in the darkness deep beneath the mountain and another creature called Gollum. Gollum was a creature similar to him at one time, but he has a precious gift that has totally taken him over in his greed and his lust for it. The gift is a ring. He refers to it as my precious. And this is no ordinary ring. This turns out to be the ring of power, another theme and symbol that goes throughout the whole Lord of the Rings, this ring that Bilbo ends up with, and that's how he escapes Gollum, and that's what brings Gollum out of his dark, dank cave down below in the mountain to chase after Bilbo. Okay, wow, so now we've got a cool story. So Bilbo ends up catching up with Gandalf, who saves the dwarves from both the trolls and now the orcs, and they get into a forest and the giant spiders, and the ring, it turns out, makes Bilbo invisible, and so now he's able to get the dwarves out of trouble. He unsheathes his sword when needed and intimidates monsters that are twice or three times or four times his size. And so we're beginning to see that he's growing into this role, not just as a burglar, but as a hero, a burglar who discovers things, confiscates things, but unaware of what he's done. And he has no idea that this ring was Gollum's. What this ring can do, he thinks it just turns him invisible. But as time goes on, we find out it is the ring of power. This ring controls other magic rings, seven total, some given to men, some to dwarves, some to elves, and elsewhere. And the bad guy of the whole series, Sauron, he's some kind of a demigod. He made this ring so that he can control all of Middle Earth through the ring, that whoever possesses the other ones eventually will fall under the corrupting spell of this ring. It's the way that he's going to assert his will over others and has done so. So he's already corrupted the men who, according to Middle Earth, were the easiest to corrupt, followed by the dwarves. The elves have a ring, but they're the least corruptible because they're so good. But eventually, they will be taken over by the power of the ring if they didn't have the ring of power destroyed. And this becomes the quest that follows the Hobbit. So there's an adventure that leads to a bigger adventure, and this is what Gandalf sees, the need for this bigger adventure that has to get started with a previous adventure with Bilbo, who ends up with this ring and is invisible. They eventually make it to their destination. The dragon is still alive. Bilbo, being invisible, is able to discover a weakness in the dragon. He goes into his lair and sees he's got a piece of scale missing right above his heart. That word gets back to men of Lake Town. One of them shoots an arrow. It goes deep into the dragon, and the dragon dies, but not before he destroys the town. And that creates a war of five armies between the dwarves, the men, and other armies, elves included, wood elves, who all want that gold. And so we see greed and pride end up just about destroying Middle Earth, until finally Bilbo and Gandalf and the whole thing has to burn itself out. Thorin gets killed, and it gets temporarily resolved. But it's showing us that in the midst of this adventure, you have lots of ups and downs with heroes and villains and successes and failures and rising again and falling again and going down into the depths and coming out of the depths only to fall back down into the depths again and only to come back out again. We experience this in life, and there are times when we're in the depths when we don't think we're ever going to get out of them. And then when we get out of them, we don't think that we're ever going to fall back into them again. But each time we rise and fall in and come out of them, something happens. There's a change that occurs. Another deep theme that's in this theme of change and of growth. In fact, the woods themselves, the forest, is what they call liminal space. That's a word that means, it literally means door or gateway into something else. So each time they go through Mirkwood or these deep forests, they're encountering deep darkness of evil, something that goes all the way back to the beginning that somehow has a manifestation there. And when they enter it and they encounter it, when they come out of it, it's one of these moments of going down into the darkness and coming out and rising on top again once they come to the other side and they're changed. So these are facts of life, and then we can derive our own hope from this, because there are times in our life when we're going to experience that in one way or another. And each time we come through it, we are built up, our character improves, something happens, something glorious. And this is all captured in this beautiful book of Tolkien. Sorry, his name just went. All right, so I've talked about the book, I've given you a quick synopsis, and you're seeing some of these themes. One other theme I want to talk about is the theme of friendship, relationships, something else very important. And it's tied, all these themes are tied to the theme of relationship. Gandalf especially, he both transcends the group and is in the group. They look up to him, and yet there are times when he is gone. They themselves bond together, then they're broken apart, then they bond together again, and then friendships are formed, friendships are lost, friendships are reformed. And it's this bond of friendship and this adventure that prepares for the future adventures that are to come, the Lord of the Rings, when that ring has to be destroyed in order to destroy the power of Sauron, the evil one, who's trying to rule the world. So friendship and relationship, defeat and glory and achievement and frustration and reluctancy and heroism and sacrifice and goodness and friendship, these are themes that are true in our own world. And the cleverness is the way they're brought out in the story. So if the story, even if it's predictable, it's still enjoyable. And even in its predictability, there's an unpredictable nature to it. And there's the mystery and the awe that comes with telling the story anyway, so that we gain something from it. So I hope you see why I love The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings so much. And I thought the Lord of the Rings trilogy in the movie was just fantastic. And then it's been redone on Amazon, and the whole genre of fantasy literature has flown out of the derivative of these books of Tolkien for good reason. So I hope you go read The Hobbit, read the whole trilogy, and discuss it. Read it aloud with your friends, with your spouse, with your children, grandchildren, and discuss it. I think that's the best way for us to have our own relationships, our own glory achieved, our own desire for heroism, our own sacrifice, and our own hunger for this kind of story to be satisfied. So thank you for joining me. I hope you love this book the way I did. Until next time, thank you.